ABC Radio Australia. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Coming up on the program this morning, 1 week left of school holidays in Vanuatu, but for the children relocated from Umbai to Maiwo Island in the recent evacuation, they may still be looking for a class come next Monday.
The school infrastructure there would be maxed out. Now I would imagine it was pretty much maxed out when I was there, just with the local people, so I can't imagine how it is now.
And Papua New Guinea's only mental health facility struggling for funds, but staff there say they can't get grants because they have no board, no governance structure, and no legal status to do so. Good morning, I'm Lauren Beldy. Thank you for your company this Tuesday. We'll have those stories and more coming up on the program. But first, New Zealand's Prime Minister says her government has approached Nauru with a direct offer to resettle refugees held in Australia's offshore detention centre there. A coalition of NGOs is urging Jacinda Ardern to resettle nearly 120 refugee and asylum seeker children and their families before Universal Children's Day on November 20. But she says while she expects it to be discussed at the Pacific Islands Forum in September, both Australia and Nauru are opposed to the proposal, suggesting it will serve as a magnet to refugees hoping to make their way to Australia. Here's Bill Bainbridge.
New Zealand has a standing offer to take refugees from Australia's offshore detention centres in the Pacific, an offer Australia has so far declined. Now, New Zealand's Prime Minister has revealed her government has bypassed Australia to make that offer directly to Nauru.
We have made the offer to take 150 refugees from Nauru and or Manus, and that offer remains. We've talked directly through various channels with the government of Nauru about that offer, as we have with the Australian government. And the government of Nauru has continued to point out that they wish to work directly to Australia in the ongoing management of the refugees.
But Australia is likely to resist New Zealand's direct involvement. Immigration Minister Peter Dutton used a rowdy question time in Parliament to attack the opposition Labor Party's record on children in detention.
The Labor Party set up Manus and Nauru. They put thousands of people onto the islands. They put 8,000 children into detention. And we have cleaned that mess up, Mr Speaker. We've closed the 17 detention centres. We've got every one of those children out of detention. And I have not had a death at sea on my watch.
And he went on to attack the opposition leader Bill Shorten's suggestion that Canada or New Zealand could take those who remain in detention on Nauru.
The trouble is Canada's not taking people from Manus and Nauru. He went on to nominate New Zealand. We've already established if you send people to New Zealand, the boats restart.
Abbas Nazari fled Afghanistan as a refugee when he was just 7 years old. He was one of the more than 400 refugees aboard the Tampa, most of whom were settled in New Zealand in 2001. Now he's the face of World Vision's campaign and its call to bring children in detention on Nauru to New Zealand.
Are we still that same New Zealand? This disgrace on our doorstep has gone on for far too long.
James Harris is Community Engagement Manager at World Vision New Zealand. He spent more than 2 years working with children in detention on Nauru.
The weight of indefinite detention, you'd really see crush children at times. And I guess they are just like every other kid, but you'd begin to sort of see almost these polar things where on one hand, they'd be playing and life would be somewhat normal. And on the other hand, you'd have the same kids beginning to withdraw, harming themselves, not wanting to leave their tents, not attending school, not playing anymore. And with time, those effects really began to compound. Yeah, pretty horrific to see.
And so what are you hoping that your Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, will do when she gets to the Pacific Island Forum in September?
Australia has said that they'll consider our offer to 150 refugees from Nauru and Manus once the deal with the US is concluded. We know, however, that the deal with the US is hindered by the travel ban, so anyone from Iran, Syria, Somalia, Yemen and other travel places have no hope of being included in that deal. So our hope is because of that hindrance that Jacinda Ardern would offer to immediately resettle all children and their families to New Zealand as an emergency intake.
But regardless of whether the asylum seekers leave Nauru, the Australian Medical Association says it's time for Australia to take greater responsibility for their well-being. Tony Bartone is the AMA president.
What was asked for is a team of appropriate independent medical physicians to try and go in there and assess the conditions and the access to care, and then report back to the Australian Parliament so that there's a transparency and a clarity and a reassurance for the Australian public about the responsibility and how we're carrying out that responsibility in terms of our international code of conduct and the expectation of Australians about those in the care of the Australian government.
President of the Australian Medical Association, Tony Bartone there, ending that report by Bill Bainbridge. Well, children in Vanuatu have one more week until the school term begins. And for most of those evacuated from Umbai Island, that means starting in a new class in a new community. Heavy ashfall from the Manara volcano meant islanders on Umbai were relocated once again to the nearby islands of Maiwo and Santo. And while it's not clear when or if the islanders will be allowed to return home, a state of emergency on Umbai is in place for at least another month. But for the children who have arrived on Maiwo, there's a problem. The government says the limited number of schools there means that not all the children relocated from Umbai Island can be accommodated. It's identified there are only 7 primary schools available for the additional 550 primary-aged children resettling there. That's in addition to an estimated 250 younger children who will need early childhood care and education. Stuart Friend is a pilot in Port Vila who was recently on Maiwo, helping to build a kindergarten in the village of Naravarovo. He says that's now being used to house around 100 evacuees at night, and the number of children who will need to use the school has approximately doubled.
The local people are being amazing by taking them in, but there's no doubt about it, it would stress the local communities, it would stress their resources for providing food and the school infrastructure there would be maxed out. Now I would imagine it was pretty much maxed out when I was there, just with the local people. So I can't imagine how it is now.
That's Stuart Friend, who's recently been on Maiwo Island building a kindergarten. He says plans are afoot to build more schools on Maiwo, but they won't be ready for a while and certainly not for the start of term next week. In the meantime, Harmbit Toa from the Ministry of Education says an 8-person team arrived on the island last week and will stay until the start of term to try to find suitable places for as many students as possible and make sure they're settling in.
They are going to spend another week out there to make sure that the students who have travelled to Maiwo have settled in a school, or if they have not settled in a school because of their capacity, then they have to make arrangements so that they will have to assist in finding a place where they can continue their education in term two.
That's Humbert Toa. He's the Basic Education Coordinator from the Ministry of Education. And before then, you heard from Stuart Friend. Well, the managers of Papua New Guinea's only mental health facility say they're struggling to accommodate an increase in referrals and desperately need more funding. So now hospital staff are urging their managers to ask for help from donor countries like Australia. But without a board, a governing structure, or even an official rating as a hospital, the psychiatric institution doesn't have the necessary credentials to be considered for many grants. Bethany Harriman reports from Port Moresby.
One of the heavy metal doors is open to show where violent patients were kept locked up. A claustrophobic room like a prison cell where more than one acute patient slept. Fights were common here. The cell has been abandoned, but on the walls are the vivid graffiti patients left behind. The place still smells like urine and feces despite the effort to clean it up. Diane Rembe, the nurse in charge of the acute ward, says the hospital management condemned this building in 2016.
We have 2 acute wards. We are using one right now. This one has been condemned and we've closed it because it's not right for people to live in.
The staff at the acute wards told the ABC there is an ongoing water problem that hasn't been solved and conditions get very bad in the cells, where up to 60 people use 3 showers and 3 toilets. Ms. Rambe says the hospital had no other option but to shut down the place despite seeing an increased number of people at the acute wards.
before it got shut down, because we had that ward open, we usually have 80 plus patients every day. But because we've shut down that, we can only receive enough patients, like 30. Both wards put in together, we can only have 27 patients. The Acute Ward, by law, we can only have 27 patients.
She says when families bring their loved ones to get help here, the nurses take them despite the lack of resources to look after them.
Our people are sick, they come for our help, we cannot send them back.
And it's not like the hospital's management didn't want to look for help. The head of medical staff, Dr. Ludwig Nanawa, says the hospital tried to write to the Australian government and others for assistance, but they simply don't have the legal status to do so.
At the moment, we cannot have a board because of the legal status of the hospital. That's one of the things we are battling right now, is that the hospital level has not been determined against the National Health Service Standards. The National Health Service Standards ranks health facilities from level 1 to 7. So level 1 would be the lowest, which is the 8th post. Level 7 would be the highest, which is a tertiary referral hospital like PMGH. Unfortunately, Lalok is not been given a level, so we don't know what level it is. That can determine whether we should have a board and all that. Once we have the governance structure in place, then it's easy to attract donor funding. Because a lot of donors, they would look at the governance structure of an institution, how they're going to handle the funding and all that.
Dr. Nanawa says the management of the institution has drawn up a restructure for the PNG Health Department to consider. PNG's Health Secretary, Pascal Kase, has responded, saying it doesn't comply with set standards and did not meet the requirements of the law. So for now, the hospital staff are doing what they can to help patients with what they have. Those who are discharged are released back into the community, continuing to live with their family if they're lucky. Others are disowned, commit serious crimes, or end up on the streets of Port Moresby.
Bethany Harriman reporting there on Papua New Guinea's only dedicated psychiatric institution. Staff there say they're in desperate need of more money, but also say they're ineligible for many forms of funding because of their legal status.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
And I'm Lauren Baldy. Lovely to have your company this morning. Well, 10 years have passed since the experiment of fielding a combined Pacific Islands rugby team featuring players from Fiji, Tonga and Samoa was abandoned. But as Richard Hewitt reports, with the joint Fiji-Samoa squad currently in action at the Super Club Netball Tournament in New Zealand, the whole concept of combined sporting teams from the islands is back on the agenda.
It's another sporting experiment. That's how coach Vicky Wilson describes the merged Fiji-Samoa side on court in the New Zealand city of Nelson, up against teams from Scotland, South Africa, Singapore and Australia, as well as from the host nation.
It's the first time this has been done at the senior level. So the girls are just really enthusiastic and excited about the prospect of playing with someone different. It makes them think and it makes us a little bit more unpredictable.
And the experiment has met with almost instant success. The Pacific team called Maramavo in their second match ever, defeating Scotland's only professional team, the Sirens, by 3 goals. So, should the Pacific Islands be looking to establish a combined team on a more permanent basis?
I think it takes a lot of work logistically. You've got to make sure everyone's on the same page and wants to achieve the same objectives. So I think it's something that we shouldn't disregard, but certainly something that we keep at the back of mind going forward.
And those sentiments are shared by Inoki Afiaki, the former Tongan rugby international who captained the inaugural Pacific Islands rugby side back in 2004.
It's for them to collectively agree and have the same vision of what purpose that team has. The product people come to watch needs to be magic. And from there, how do they go about doing it? And how regularly do they do it? So not overdo it. It just needs the right business model to make sure that we cash in.
And that's where the problem started for the Pacific Island rugby experiment. It was meant to be a money spinner for the Pacific Unions and the team was meant to play every 2 years. But when the IRB changed the schedule to every 4 years, Samoa decided enough was enough and bailed out. Furthermore, there were concerns that the national teams were suffering at the expense of the combined squad.
A national team had to give up its game in Europe to allow the Pacific Islands team to play, which is not the ideal situation because you're now in conflict.
However, Inoki Afiaki says it was a great product and would be worth looking at again, only this time the islands would have to ensure they got the right deal.
TV coverage is where the big sources of money is at. We've just got to make sure that we get enough back from it that we can grow the game what we need. There's really good negotiators to carve out what is fair.
As far as the new netball venture is concerned, they have Sky Television coverage in New Zealand, so that's a good start. And Vicky Wilson says the idea of a Pacific Islands touring team is certainly worth considering.
I would like to think that that's possible, particularly with your pool, your resources and your finances, you become a lot stronger and more competitive. So it's just a matter of being able to find those competitions. And the big thing is being able to work out how to get together to get some training under your belt as well.
As Director of Operations for the Tonga Association of Sports and National Olympic Committee these days, Inoki Afiaki is not averse to examining the idea of sending a combined islands team to the Olympics. After all, Britain do it. And as for the rugby experiment, he has fond memories of what was so good about it.
It was phenomenal. Just a surreal situation to be surrounded by guys that could outrun, outjump, outdo the teams that we were faced against, Australia, New Zealand and South Africa at the time.
Boy, there's some pace in this team. Sammy Vatu's looming. If he gets the pass, he's gone. He has got it, and he is gone.
The only difference was we hadn't had years of preparation.
So for now, rugby fans in the islands can only imagine what such a team could do if it had that preparation. But perhaps what is happening on the netball court in New Zealand right now might just make the decision makers think differently about the best way to get the best out of Pacific sporting talent.
Richard Hewitt there on the concept of combined Pacific Islands sports teams. Well, Tonga's Prime Minister Akilisi Pohiva had a change of heart last week. On Thursday, he called on Pacific countries to join together to ask China to write off their debts. On Friday, he called it off, saying infrastructure loans from China were crucial for the kingdom's recovery and economic stability. But the Tongan leader is not the only one who has voiced his desire to have his country's debt to China renegotiated. Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad has been meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping over the past few days, having vowed to discuss investment deals worth tens of billions of dollars that he's claimed are unfair. John West is an adjunct professor at Sophia University in Tokyo and the author of The Asian Century on a Knife Edge. He's argued that China is a more fragile superpower than many of us think and may be forced to forgive more debt in the future. He spoke earlier with ABC The World's Beverly O'Connor.
Well, China, I think, is fragile in several respects. Firstly, the domestic economy is fragile because of an enormous debt and also ageing population, which is ageing quickly now. Secondly, the domestic political scene is becoming more and more repressive as the Communist Party represses the society to maintain control. And thirdly, externally, China is, being more assertive and, antagonizing many of its neighbors.
And that's a very good point. I mean, you do see that significantly over the last year, particularly where Xi Jinping is establishing a very strong authoritarian rule. Why then might it be sort of just fragile? Why might it all collapse?
The population could revolt against the domestic repression. The economic problems could also lead to a financial crisis or more likely a period of economic stagnation and therefore frustration amongst the middle classes.
You do see Xi Jinping playing hardball, though, with countries that have got caught up in China's largesse. Do you see this continuing? Do you see him being forced to sometimes forgive debts like we've seen with the Pacific nations?
Yes, possibly, because many of the projects we're seeing, for example, in Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Malaysia and elsewhere, the projects are not always in the interest of the local country. The projects are operated by Chinese staff and employ Chinese equipment and so on, and leave the countries with big debts which they just simply can't pay.
Australia has staked a lot of its own policy on this pivot to Asia. Should we be resetting that?
Asia is critical importance for Australia, but Australia, I think, has suffered from a China obsession, and so many of our government leaders and business leaders are obsessed with China. And as India grows more strongly, I think we need to diversify ourselves more, put not all of our eggs in the China basket, and try and cooperate more with India, as the government is planning to do. And secondly, to work with ASEAN, the countries from Southeast Asia, notably Indonesia, our closest big country.
That's adjunct professor at Sophia University in Tokyo, John West, speaking with The World's Beverly O'Connor. Well, already the fisheries sector accounts for nearly a fifth of Solomon Islands' gross domestic product, but that figure could rise as the company National Fisheries Development expands its operations into Kiribati. As Evan Wasuka reports, the firm's managing director, Frank Wickham, says the move has been made possible by the purchase of a purse seiner, which means bigger catches and the ability to fish further from home.
With 11 vessels in all, including a second large persona in its fleet now, the National Fisheries Development is entering a new phase of operation. Managing Director Frank Wickham says their latest boat, the Solomon Topaz, gives them the capacity to become an international operator and fish well beyond Solomon waters.
She is currently fishing in Kiribati waters. She was bought to increase our catch and to enable us to catch further, make use of the mechanisms that are available to us in the under the parties to the Nauru Agreement. We fish under the what they call the FSMA, Federated States of Micronesia arrangement, where we're able to fish in other PNA waters in the Pacific. So we're utilizing that arrangement to fish beyond Solomon waters and bring the fish back to Soltuna for processing.
But Mr. Wickham says growth in capacity also comes with challenges.
It's a new era for us to actually fish outside. We've not gone beyond our waters, and it's a new experience for us in terms of managing bigger boats and in managing keeping with the compliance regimes that are in place for the PNA FSMA arrangement.
Loans worth a total of $20 million from the International Finance Corporation have helped to cover the cost of both purse seiners for NFD. And when they're in full operation, they're expected to increase the company's annual catch by 7,000 metric tons. IFC has also funded the upgrade of Soltuna, Solomon Islands' tuna processing factory. And Dennis Mione, chief executive of the National Chamber of Commerce, is expecting to see a flow-on effect for the wider economy.
The investment, the $10 billion, is just a positive, message for the economy, because more jobs will be created. But also you're looking at the very micro level, services, contracting services that will be given to other, small, medium enterprise in Nauru. So I guess this is quite a huge investment coming to Solomon Islands, and I think we should applaud and acknowledge NFD in its quest for expanding its fishing capability.
Nauru in Western Province is home to both NFD and Soltuna. The town is regarded as Solomon Islands tuna capital, and Western Province Premier David Ginner says the growth in the tuna sector is good news for his government.
With a new idea and the expansion of NFD, there will be more people being employed by NFD, and I have an audience from the CEO of Soltuna last week. And they are thinking in the same line to continue expand. And so I'm very happy that both industries will continue to help Western Province grow.
And as well as bringing in more revenue, the anticipated growth in Solomon Islands' tuna industry is expected to create 150 new jobs as well.
Evan Wasuka there reporting on what could be a boon to the Solomon Islands' tuna industry. Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of Pacific Beat. I'll be back same time tomorrow, 6 a.m. PNG time, or catch Bill Bainbridge this afternoon at 3 p.m. PNG time. And if you have access to ABC television, keep an eye out for the Foreign Correspondent program coming up this evening at 8 p.m. PNG time. It follows Sean Dorney, the Papua New Guinea correspondent who reported on the country and the Pacific region for more than 40 years, as he embarks on what is possibly his last visit to the country he loves so much as he battles motor neurone disease. For those of you who can't catch that program, we'll be sure to bring you coverage here on Pacific Beat in the coming episodes. But that's all for this morning. I'm Lauren Beldy. Thank you so much for your company. Bye for now.